You're listening to the Growing Leaders Podcast, episode number 13.
Hi there. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast. I'm here with Dr. Tim Elmore to talk about a blog he wrote back in February called The Three Huge Mistakes We Make Leading Kids and How to Correct Them. We felt like it would be great to talk in depth about this topic on today's podcast. Tim, since you wrote the blog back in February, it has over 737,000 shares on Facebook. Take just a moment and share why you thought this particular post went viral.
Well, this was the kind of blog that I write about every day, but I think this one went viral because I was talking about three huge mistakes we make leading kids to a generation of parents and teachers and coaches and youth workers that I think have quietly wondered, is the way we're doing it really right? And is there unintended consequences to all the affirmation we're throwing out, telling kids they're awesome? And of course, we want to be encouragers of kids, but I think there's been a quiet questioning among parents that I see, what has gone wrong and how can I fix it? So I think that's why this particular post was popular.
Now, the original thought behind this blog came from an actual story. Why don't we kick off today by sharing that story with our listeners?
Well, what inspired this podcast was actually a snapshot. I was reading recently about a guy named Paul Wallach. He's a dad, a typical dad in the Midwest, he's an engineer, so he built this drone helicopter that could literally fly with his son as his son went to the bus stop every day for school. I'm not kidding. The helicopter hovered over him as he made his way, and Paul could literally watch his child get to the bus stop. Now, there may be several parents wondering, how can I get one of those? But no doubt in my mind it was fun. In fact, I'm sure it provided great fodder for show and tell for his son at school. But for me, as far as I'm concerned, Paul Wallach gives a whole new definition to helicopter parents. And I think this blog post where we talk about these three huge mistakes really is about us hovering too much and maybe not allowing them to actually grow up.
Thanks for giving our listeners some of the inspiration for this blog. Let's jump right into mistake number one. We risk too little.
Yeah, I don't know what you who are listening, I don't know what you think about this one, but I feel like one gigantic error we make is that we just risk far too little as we begin to raise or develop these children. Think about it. We live in a world that warns us of danger at every turn. We are a safety-first culture. We're obsessed with it. Toxic, high voltage, flammable, slippery when wet, steep curve ahead, don't walk, hazard. I mean, there signs like that are everywhere. And I think while they're all right on, spot on, in fact, who doesn't want their kids safe in today's very complex world? I think by overdoing it, we create risk-averse children, and we become risk-averse adults. In fact, I think it all started back in the 1980s, the Tylenol scare back in 1982, where those Tylenol pills were laced with poison and they were yanked off the shelves. Well, that was September of 1982. The next month is October. Kids are going out trick-or-treating, getting candy from strangers. I mean, it was as though with one voice, parents rose up, formed PTA meetings, formed hotlines, and said, we're going to keep these kids safe. On top of that, that same decade, we started seeing photos of children appearing on milk cartons. They were, abducted or kidnapped, and we thought, oh, God, please don't let that happen to my kid. But all of this began to lead to this culture where knee pads and safety belts and helmets are placed on these children wherever they go. I mean, my goodness, helmets are on them at dinner time, it seems like these days. So all of this has led to this risk-averse society. Here's the downside. According to the research that I've been doing, it's had this adverse effect. For instance, children of risk-averse parents actually have turned out to have lower test scores and are slightly less likely to attend college than offspring of parents with more tolerant attitudes toward risk. And that's coming from Sarah Brown at the University of Sheffield in the UK. Aversion to risk may prevent parents from making inherently uncertain investments in their children's human capital. And it's also possible that risk attitudes reflect cognitive ability, researchers say. Harvard Business Review actually had an entire article on this, and they basically underscore the fact that unless we do something about this, we're going to have kids that enter the working world afraid to make certain decisions. In fact, we see this. A few years ago, a book came out called Quarter Life Crises. I'm not sure if you heard of this book. We've all heard of midlife crises. We baby boomers went through that one years ago. But quarter life crises is about the growing number of 25-year-old young adults who are going into clinical depression because they didn't make their first million by 25 or find the perfect spouse at 25 or get the perfect job at 25. And if they did, they were afraid to make that commitment. So again, nobody saw this coming perhaps, but it's one of those unintended consequences of a well-intentioned mistake. Let's don't take any risk. Let's keep them safe. Psychologists in Europe have discovered that if a child doesn't play outside and is never allowed to experience a skinned knee or a broken bone, they frequently have phobias as adults. Jim, you know this. 20 years, we talked about this. 20 years ago, monkey bars and jungle gyms began to be removed from the public playgrounds across America. Well, that's a normal move. Parents wanted kids to not fall down from that monkey bar and break their arm or skin their knee. The problem is now they're finding those same kids who are now 29, not 9, and they're finding out they're having fears and phobias about simple things because they never mitigated risk. They never learned to navigate risk back as an elementary school kid when they should have learned it. All this is to say, I don't think it's the end of the world, but we've got to learn to enable our kids to take those risks that they need to take, to make their way through life where they skin their knee or they break their arm and they cry and you cry with them and you hold them, but you say, this is all part of growing up. In fact, let me be frank. For a kid that does play outside, that does break his arm or her arm, they get a cast, several of their friends sign it, 6 weeks later it comes off, and you know what they think? Ah, I can do this. I can break my arm and I make it through the break. So this is the kinds of things I think we need to do, and very, very often we fail at this first need.
Sometimes we see parents begin to allow their children to venture into new territory and responsibilities, but then the moment that that child hits difficulty or a challenge, the parent is right by their side to take back over. This leads us to the second mistake, which is we rescue too quickly.
Yeah, Jim, mistake number one is a second cousin to the next one. We do risk too little, but then we rescue too quickly. You're right. Sometimes we do end up allowing our kids to take some risks. But maybe then we find out they have failed to bring their homework to school, or they failed to, maybe it's much older, they're now in high school or college and they failed to do something. I believe this generation of kids many times, not every time, but many times, has learned that very rapidly some adult will swoop in with a Superman cape on and solve their problem. They will rescue them. We won't let these kids fail. And we won't let them fail for a number of reasons. One, they're a reflection of us. The parents or the teachers. God forbid they fail. That looks like I'm a horrible teacher or horrible parent. So again, we don't let them fail. We don't let them take those risks. Or when we do, that we rescue them. The problem here seems rather obvious to me. If a child grows up knowing someone's going to rescue me, they learn to lean on that. They learn to depend on someone else solving the problem, so their problem-solving skills are diminished. Like a muscle that atrophies inside a cast, that muscle atrophies. They never learn to really do the problem-solving themselves. I know this sounds harsh, but I believe rescuing and overindulging our children is one of the most insidious forms of child abuse. It's often parenting for the short term, and it sorely misses the point of leadership to equip our young people to do what they need to do without help. And again, like I referred to earlier, just like muscles atrophy inside a cast due to disuse, I believe our kids' social, emotional, and spiritual and intellectual muscles can shrink if they don't get used. And if we're rescuing all the time, they're not getting used. For instance, I'll give you a good example. I remember exactly when and where I learned the art of conflict resolution. I was about 11 years old, and here's where it took place. We had a big ball field out back of our house. And after all the guys in the neighborhood got their homework done, we all go out there, about 20 of us, and we choose up sides, and we umpire our own games. Through that, I learned conflict resolution. You can imagine. Today, if the kids are outside at all, they might be inside in front of a screen, there are four mothers out there doing the conflict resolution for them. Now, we smile at this, but it's true. We are doing it for them with well-intentioned hearts to say, I care for my child, so I'm going to solve their problem. The problem is they turn 25 eventually, or 30, or 35, and they still are without the life skills that they desperately need to make it through life. The fact is, as students experience adults doing so much for them, they like it at first. Who wouldn't like mom coming in with a backpack when I forgot it, or the teacher making sure I get a passing grade so I get to get through fourth grade or 10th grade for that matter? But I think they learn to play parents against each other. They learn to play teachers against each other. They learn to negotiate with faculty for more time, lenient rules, extra credit, easier grades. And this actually confirms, here's the message we're sending. If we rescue them, they're getting the quiet message, I can't do this. Mom does not think I'm good enough, so she comes in and does it for me. That's not the message we want to send, but it's the message we're sending when we do it for them. Think about it. If I fail or act out, an adult's going to help me. I'm going to grow up as a bonehead and maybe even move back home when I'm done with college because I'm just not ready for the real world. So once again, let me just give a helpful thought before we go into the final mistake. If your child or your student or your teen gets in trouble with an unfinished project, a bad grade, I don't know, a failure, a relationship conflict, tough decision, whatever, I think we need to be ready to talk to them, but we must not solve the problem for them. We need to help them process how they got into the situation and what they've learned from it. Then we need to ask questions to help them think about solutions to the dilemma they face. We need to give them support, but we need to encourage them to take whatever steps they got to take and learn the problem solving themselves.
That's great, Tim. This brings us to our final point, which is much different than what you've shared already. Mistake one and two were both about allowing children to learn, and at times through trial and error, instead of the leader making all the decisions for them. Mistake number three is we rave too easily.
Yeah, I do think this is a mistake, and I need to first concede something. I am, I think, predisposed to be an encourager. I love encouraging children. I encouraged my own two kids as they were growing up. They're now grown adults. But as we work with students, I love giving them praise for what they have done. Now, note what I just said, for what they have done, not for what they've not done. I believe we live in a generation of parents and teachers, for that matter, that we have been conditioned not only about the safety thing, but about the self-esteem thing. We did not want this generation of children to grow up with poor self-esteem. In fact, we're in the throes of a self-esteem revolution. There are thousands of educational articles right there, you can Google them, about the self-esteem of children. So we have been absolutely committed to good self-esteem. The problem is we made the mistake of thinking that self-esteem can come simply from affirmation. So from birth up, our kids have heard words like, you're awesome, you're smart, you're gifted, you're super, you're amazing. And we meant well. But think about it. As a kid grows older, they get past 5 years old. Now they're 10, maybe they're 12, maybe they're 15 years old. It works when they're young. I mean, who doesn't love the adrenaline that comes when mom says, I'm awesome. But by the time they reach 10 years old, they may be saying to themselves, well, wow, mom's the only one saying I'm awesome. My friends don't say it. My teacher, you know, what's going on here? And there's a disparity between the real world, which they're wanting to be a part of, and this fluffy world that just is not connected to reality. So what I want you to hear me is now is this. Of course we must encourage kids. We must affirm what they have done. But we need to be careful that we're not throwing out empty raves, empty encouragement, empty praise. Think about it. This generation of kids, you can see a snapshot of just going to a Little League's award ceremony. I mean, everybody gets a trophy. Everybody gets a ribbon just for showing up, just for playing on the team. I know that's been said 1,000 times, but quite frankly, 2 summers ago, I went to a Little League's award ceremony myself, and I saw a kid. Well, first of all, I saw ribbons given. I saw ninth place ribbons given out. Now, just think about that. Ninth place. Man, I tell you, when I played ball growing up, it was first place or runner-up after that. Come back next year, man. You all lost, right. You know? Well, secondly, that night of this award ceremony, I watched a kid about 11 years old give the trophy back to his dad. He said, this doesn't mean anything. And the reason he did that was he was realizing everybody gets this. And especially for guys, for boys, this starts becoming hollow at best. In fact, almost fake. They know this isn't real. there is something competitive inside of them that they know this isn't real. So I think, again, can I say it again? It works at 5. It doesn't work at 10. Certainly not at 15. And we're just boneheads if we keep doing it when they're 20 years old. I often say this. These kids are not stupid. I just wonder if we are, okay? Robert Cloninger at Washington University in St. Louis has done some brain research on the prefrontal cortex. We read a lot about this today. The prefrontal cortex is what monitors the reward center of the brain. He says the brain has to learn that frustrating spells can be worked through. The reward center of our brains learns to say, don't give up, don't stop trying. And a person who grows up getting too frequent rewards or raves, if you will not have the persistence because they'll quit when the rewards disappear. In other words, think about it. They're no longer motivated from an inward motivation of, I want to do this well. It's getting the prizes, getting the affirmation. And pretty soon, the endorphins are flowing. But when the praise stops, so does the effort. It's scary. I love sharing about actually two experiments. One, Carol Dweck writes about, Jim, where she had a sneaking suspicion that all this praising that we were doing of children wasn't getting the intended results. She was working at the time at Columbia University. She's at Stanford now. She took two groups of 10-year-old kids, both in fifth grade, and both were given a set of tests. They were equal. The tests were equal. But after one group was given the test, they were told, you must be smart. When the second group was given the test, they were told, you must have tried really hard. Now, do you notice they were rewarding, they were affirming effort, not scores. Here's what's interesting. Carol Dweck's concerns were addressed. When a second round of tests were given, and they were told, you don't have to take this one. This is much harder. It's a seventh grade test. Do you want to take it? Almost none of the first group that were told they were smart wanted to take it. It was almost as though they thought, you've already told me I'm smart. I have a sneaking suspicion you're wrong. I know that I'm really not. So God forbid I ever deconfirm what you've just said. I just won't play. If I can't win the game, I don't want to play. So they stopped trying at all. All the praise actually led to the opposite thing they were wanting. Now, here's what's interesting. The second group that was told, you must have really tried hard, all of them wanted to take the test. And even though none of them did well on it because it was a seventh grade test, Carol Dweck and her team said they heard the kids whispering under their breath as they took the test, this is my favorite test. This is my favorite test. They were actually exhilarated by the effort they had to put forth because they had the effort affirmed. Now, the last set of tests were given out to these kids. It was now a fifth grade level test, which matched who they were. The first group, which was forced to take it, did 30% worse than the first time around. And the second group did measurably better. And the point that Carol Dweck was making is, first of all, we're praising way too much and too empty. And secondly, we need to praise what's in their control. When you're told you're smart, you're thinking, well, either I am or I'm not, but there's nothing I do about it. But if you say, Jim, I love the way you worked at that, or I love how honest you are, that's something that's in your control. And what gets rewarded gets repeated. So again, it's stuff that's fundamental. We all know better, but sometimes we make these mistakes without even realizing what we're doing. One last experiment, and I'll wrap up. Daniel Pink writes in his book, Drive, about an incredible illustration it was actually preschool kids, four and 5 years old. The first group they called the reward group. They said, if you'll draw a picture, we're going to give you a prize. Well, naturally, all of them wanted to draw a picture. Yeah, I like to draw and I love prizes. The second group was asked to draw a picture, but they were not told about the prize. They were going to get one, but they weren't told. They drew the picture and then they got a prize. The third group, they didn't say anything about the prize, and of course, nothing happened at the end. Here's the interesting part. After they did this first round of test, 2 weeks later, they came back for a second round. And the second round, the first group was asked, do you want to draw another picture? We'd like you to draw one, only there's no prize this time. Almost none of the kids wanted to draw because it became about the prize, not the drawing, not the intrinsic satisfaction I get when I draw a picture. The second group and the third group both wanted to draw because they hadn't been told about a prize. The point was simply this. Are we building inward motivation or just external stimulation through ribbons and trophies and praise? And I'm thinking you know the answer. So bottom line, we risk too little, we rescue too quickly, and we rave too easily.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Tim. As you were talking, it occurred to me that when we have parents and teachers that are constantly giving us the answers, we lose the opportunity to learn how to problem solve. But not being allowed to experiment and make mistakes and then learn from those experiences, we become dependent on having those people in our lives. In closing, I want to give you, our audience, two ways to continue to learn more about this topic. Tim has taken this blog and expanded it into an in-depth book for you. This is an ebook for your Kindle or your iPad. You can go to growingleaders.com and download it for only 99 cents. The second is this. Go to growingleaders.com/blog and subscribe to Tim's blog. Each day we cover many topics about education, parenting, and leadership. In 3 weeks, we will share with you another podcast. It's actually going to be a follow-up podcast to today's topic, where we will go into 10 different ways that we can lead our kids better. That wraps it up for today. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Growing Leaders Podcast.